Thanks for joining A&M Conversation With, a podcast series featuring Alvarez and Marsal leaders discussing the trends impacting businesses today. In part two of a two-part series of A&M Conversation With, Dr. David Gruber, a managing director with our healthcare industry group, sits down with Peter Urbanowitz, a managing director with our healthcare industry group, and John Cox, a managing director with our public sector services, to discuss potential winners and losers of the new American Healthcare Act. What will this mean for Medicaid?
Peter and John, thank you for joining us today. This is part two of a series of conversations on the future of Obamacare. Peter, what are your latest thoughts on the House Republican plan released Monday night?
Thanks, David. Thanks for doing this call. I'm not too surprised by the package. In fact, I think most of what's in the package had already been telegraphed by the House leadership a few weeks ago when they put out an outline, and almost a year ago with Speaker Paul Ryan's plan on how he thought the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare should be redone. So what they've done, as predicted, was they're trying to keep the popular parts of Obamacare, those being the pre-existing condition protections and adult children being able to remain on their parents' insurance policy through age 26. And it jettisons the unpopular parts of the Affordable Care Act, that being the individual and employer mandates, the health insurance premium taxes, the medical device and drug taxes, and then the Medicare surtax. So those things go away. What it also does is it keeps the idea of a subsidy to individuals who can't otherwise afford health insurance or who don't have employer coverage or who are not on Medicare or Medicaid. And it moves from Obamacare, a direct subsidy to the insurance company for that individual, to a refundable tax credit, which is money's money, but it's a different way of putting it. And it's a more conservative view or conservative way of providing assistance to individuals through a tax credit as opposed to a direct subsidy. So from that perspective, I'm not too surprised by the way the package has come together, because many of the provisions in it were already telegraphed to the broader audience a few weeks ago. What is interesting, though, or what wasn't in the previous plan that was put out, was how do they do this transition? How do they move from the current Obamacare to this new plan? How do they make sure that people are not dropped off the insurance rolls? And how do they protect those states which decided to expand Medicaid under Obamacare? And so what they have done is provided a window between the time the bill passes and December 31st, 2019, where there's this transition period, and we move from what's currently in place under Obamacare into this new plan. So this transition period, the way that they have put that together, is new. The other thing is the Medicaid block grant provisions in this bill, which, although telegraphed that was something they were going to do, they put a tremendous amount of detail about how the way that would actually work now.
And John, what are the implications to Medicaid?
Implications to Medicaid, David, are huge. Medicaid has historically, since 1965, been an open-ended entitlement program. So if you're a state, you're enrolling providers, you're enrolling participants, those participants receive services, they send a bill to the state pays the bill, and then quarterly, the state sends a bill to the federal government for its share. So it's open-ended. As much money as you spend, that's how much money the federal government will pay its share. What this bill proposes is a radical change in that, which is a per capita cap, meaning there are four existing categories today: blind, elderly, disabled, children, and adults. They're adding a fifth one in this bill, but those five categories will each receive a specific dollar amount per state. Again, very, very different than the way Medicaid operates today. So instead of an open-ended entitlement, the federal government is essentially saying, we're going to control our risk of spending, which is a primary driver, as Peter mentioned, of the Speaker Ryan's proposal. So that's a big, big fundamental shift, dramatic shift in the way the program is operated. A couple of other things are going to be in the bill. There's going to be a $10 billion number of appropriations over a five-year period for states that have not expanded under the Affordable Care Act. That will be done primarily as a safety net payment for those states that did not expand. Secondly, there's going to be a $100 billion program over 9 years, with specific appropriations per year to allow for basically high-risk pools. So one of the concerns you've already heard raised on the bill is you have all these people that have multiple diagnoses and they, you know, are very expensive to care for. How in the world as a state, if you're going to cap our funding, are we going to be able to do that? So I think one of the things that the authors of the bill have done is add this additional funding into the repeal bill to allow for incentives for states either to apply for grants to use it for specifically those high acuity individuals or allow for those dollars to be spent on high risk pools. So some really big changes, David, coming down the pike for Medicaid if this bill becomes law.
And John, you didn't mention the word block grants and you didn't mention waivers. What's happening there?
Good question. There was some discussion about a block grant. The difference very simply in a block grant and per capita is a block grant is one number for a state. So here, Mr. Ms. State, here is a number. Here's the funding. You spend it and allocate it among all the programs as you see fit. With per capita funding, which is what's being proposed in the legislation, there are specific populations, again, elderly, blind, disabled, children, adults, and then expansion adults that are going to be taken care of under separate dollar limits. So it allows, in theory, a little more flexibility for the state. The other issue you mentioned is waivers. I do think, as Peter mentioned in the beginning, that there's a so-called 1115 demonstration waiver. I think the new administration is going to look very favorably to states that file those waivers that are really trying to be very creative in how they deal with their Medicaid populations, whether that's healthcare, whether it's intellectual disabilities, whether it's mental health. So I do predict that the federal government, which is now being run obviously by a new administration, will be more predictable and more flexible in their approval of those types of waivers. The final thing I'll mention is HCBS, home and community-based waivers. At least as the bill is written, it's pretty silent as to that. So I think for those states that are dealing with individuals in a community setting, primarily long-term care and intellectual disabilities, we don't see any changes coming down the pike as of this moment.
Okay, thanks. And last question, Peter. Based on preliminary feedback, the House Republican plan does not appear to be a slam dunk. So what's the process from here?
So you're right. This is not a slam dunk for Speaker Ryan or for President Trump. This is going to be threading a needle. You can guarantee pretty much that there will be few to none Democratic votes for this bill on the House floor. So that means that Speaker Ryan's going to have to keep nearly all of his members on board for whatever bill emerges. Procedurally, what happens next is the bill goes to two committees of jurisdiction, that being the House Ways and Means Committee and then the House Energy and Commerce Committee, because House Ways and Means is in charge of any bills that deal with taxes, and House Energy and Commerce is in charge of any bill that deals with Medicaid. So both of those committees now have this bill. They will mark it up, which means they will have a hearing where they will go through the bill section by section, make amendments as they believe appropriate, either to satisfy members of the committee or to try to make sure that they can bring on all the Republican votes that they need. And then once those amendments are there, it goes to the House floor. The amendments between the two committees will be harmonized with each other, and it'll go to the House floor for a vote. Speaker Ryan wants to bring a bill to the House floor before the April recess, and I think he will. The question is whether he can keep enough Republicans on board to have his majority to get this bill through the House. And it's not just getting it through the House and getting those conservative votes. He needs to make sure that the bill that emerges from the House is going to keep all of the Republicans on board in the Senate. Because again, in the Senate, it's unlikely to attract many Democratic votes. So Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, will need each and every Republican vote in the Senate that he has. And in order to do that, the bill may have to be a little bit more generous on the Senate side than it is on the House side to keep all of the conservative Republican votes. So this is very much threading a needle, not only for Speaker Ryan, but for President Trump, who's going to have to put a lot of his personal popularity, his personal credibility with Republican voters in Republican districts on the line.
Thanks, Peter. Our next podcast will focus on the likely winners and losers. key question. Thanks, everyone.
For our listeners, for more information, visit our homepage at alvarezandmarsal.com and connect with us on LinkedIn at Alvarez and Marsal.